Daniel, we're going to read and study from the book of Daniel today. Look at the story of Daniel. Take a lesson from his life about integrity, in particular spiritual integrity, and how we can make ourselves holy by fully and completely and truly committing ourselves to the will of God. So we'll be talking about Daniel today. Let's start with just to understand what we mean by the word integrity. It has to do with being honest, but it's really a bigger word than just telling the truth and not stealing. The idea of integrity, as it's defined, can be unimpaired state, solid, something that's stable. And so we talk about the integrity of a building. Are there cracks in it? Is the foundation got a weak corner or something like that? And so is it solid? Is it stable? It appears to be strong or even or built correctly, but the integrity is going to be found in whether that's true all the way through rather than just what appears on the front of the building. And so the idea of being undivided or an unbroken state or completeness, we can see how that works with the other, and then some synonyms as well. And so we're not talking just about the importance of being honest and telling the truth. We're talking about what we are through and through. It's a big word that identifies a lot of features in our character. In the things that we're supposed to add to our faith, the first is virtue. It comes from a Greek word, arete. And virtue there does mean goodness or moral goodness. But what it's really talking about is the idea of an excellence of moral character that runs across many levels and many applications. Again, it's like this word integrity, that we are who we ought to be. We are solid and healthy or strong all the way through. What you see is a consistency of life, regardless of circumstances. And so the idea of integrity, you know, who do you trust? But more importantly, the question should be, and I should have changed this, but who trusts you? And are you dependable? Are you solid? Are you what you claim to be and what you appear to be? And certainly that can be true, can be considered and be true in a secular sense, in this world, in business, in our word, in this life. We're going to be talking about it from a spiritual standpoint. And we're going to use Daniel as a picture of true spiritual integrity. And that does involve this faithfulness over time and through all kinds of circumstances. In the book of Daniel in chapter 1, and we'll just kind of survey the story right now and come back and look at some things more closely. We're looking at a period of history for the Israelites when Judah, the southern kingdom, is being taken into captivity. Now the northern kingdom had been taken into Assyrian captivity about 100 years previously. But now Judah has fallen so far from God that his judgment is finally upon them. And you can read in verse 1, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem to besiege it. And so it's the first attack on the city of Jerusalem. Now when we talk about the fall of Jerusalem or Babylonian captivity of the Judeans and the Israelites in and around Jerusalem, it was in three stages because Nebuchadnezzar came and conquered the city and then set a king in place and said, okay, you do what I tell you to do and you pay your taxes to me and you behave yourself, I will leave you alone. You can take care of your own local business. And that's where the prophet Jeremiah is prophesying for God and telling them the message of God is, what is happening to you is your own fault. You have been unfaithful to God, and Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire is my judgment against you. You yield to it, you submit to it, and you do what the king of Babylon tells you to do. That's the prophecy of Jeremiah. How popular do you think Jeremiah was among the Israelites with that kind of a message? The Israelites turned against Jeremiah, and a variety of problems in the pit and tried to kill him and just all kinds of things against Jeremiah. But over and over again, the Israelites would get fed up with the Babylonians and say, that's enough, we're going to rebel against the Babylonians to get our freedom. And so then, here they come again, and that would be besiege number two, and then number three. And finally, at the third time, all the people, except for the weak and the sick and the old, all were taken into captivity, and the city was completely destroyed. The temple was completely burned. Everything was destroyed on the third. But Daniel was with the group that was taken the first time. And so Daniel here, with others, is being taken into captivity. And it was told, the servants, that you look for the healthiest, the smartest. You look for these young men that I can train up in my service, so that they will serve in special capacities in my kingdom. That was Nebuchadnezzar's instruction. And when they were taken, these good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, when they were taken, they would be taught the language and the literature of the Chaldeans. They would be put on a Chaldean diet. They would associate with Chaldean people. They were in school to become good servants of the Babylonian Empire. Babylon, Chaldea, those names are used interchangeably. Among them were Daniel, but also Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. We know them better by their Babylonian names, that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Daniel, for some reason, keeps his Hebrew name in the book, even though he got a Babylonian name along with the rest of them. But they were taken among others. And Daniel, as he began to find himself in this new environment, was a long way from home. He was separated from the law and from the priesthood, and from the temple, and from the opportunity to offer sacrifices, or do anything that would be in connection with God's people and God's ways spiritually. And so now he is in a university, in a faraway city, without any believers around him. You know, we ought to be able to relate to Daniel. We see ourselves in circumstances like this sometimes. Well, we're separated from those things that can sustain us and uphold our faith and pull us in the right direction. And we're in an environment that is working completely against us. In fact, it has as its purpose to change our thinking, to change our character, and change our behavior to become someone else, to become a Babylonian, to become a Babylonian servant to the king. Well, in verse chapter 1 still, in verse 8, but Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank, which he requested from the chief of the eunuchs, that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and the goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. You can read the story, continue through chapter 1. And so we've got this conflict now, because Daniel is saying to the steward, this eunuch that's in charge of his welfare and his training, keep him healthy and putting him to school and turn him into a good Babylonian. Daniel says, I'm not going to eat those things. We assume, and I think it's fair to make this assumption, that the reason Daniel did not want to do this is, well, he said it would defile him. Well, that must be his commitment to what he understood the law of God to say, that there are foods you cannot eat, and there's drink that you should be very careful about. And as Daniel was committed to God, he was committed to those habits that were still in his mind at this point. How old was Daniel at this point? We don't know exactly, because it doesn't say. It does say that they were looking for young men. Well, how young? Well, at the end of chapter 1, as Daniel is successful, there's a statement that goes all the way to the end of the story, and really near the end of Daniel's life. It says, thus Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. When did Cyrus become king? Cyrus became king when he was the king of the Persians, when the Persians conquered the Babylonians. And the Persians are the ones who decided, we're sending the Israelites home if they want to go. The restoration. Jeremiah says, and in the history books indicate as well, this is mentioned more than once, that it would be 70 years. So Daniel was in Babylon for at least 70 years. So how old was he when he went to Babylon? Was he 30? Was he 12? I just like the word, I like the number 12. 12 is a nice number. You can take a 12-year-old and turn him into anything you want. good, healthy young man. Let's teach him our ways and teach him our doctrines and teach him our language, and we'll have a Babylonian servant. And if he's 12, well, that means by the time he serves under King Cyrus, he's 72 years old. Did I do that right? No, 70 and 12 is 82 years old. He's 82 years old. That's, I guess, a fair guess. And it's my guess, so you can do your own guess. But he's a young guy. He's a young guy. Is he 22 maybe? Well, then he's 92, right? Maybe he is 22. Maybe God blessed him with an extra long life. But he's not a mature person yet. In a vulnerable place, in a vulnerable circumstance, and at a vulnerable age. But he purposed in his heart that he was not going to defile himself. And he had the courage to speak up and to refuse. And that's amazing that he did that. And he said, well, why don't you just let us eat what we want to eat for 10 days, and then you just judge for yourself. And at that point, you do whatever you feel you have to do. He didn't say, at that point, we'll eat your food. He didn't say that, did he? He says, you let us eat what we want for 10 days, and then you judge us, and then you do whatever you have to do. Sounds like there's a second statement that he didn't say, and that is, and I'll do what I have to do. Because it takes that kind of attitude to do what Daniel did at this point, and for it to continue for 70 years. So that's where we're starting out here, as we talk about Daniel in this beginning, and as a result of God's blessing and his faithfulness, the text says that they excelled beyond all of the other young men in their training, in their understanding, in their wisdom, in their thinking, and they impressed the king, and they impressed everyone around them. And it was clear that this was something very special in these young men. Well, in chapter 2, we don't know how much time has passed, but by now they're well graduated out of this program, and now they're among the wise men of the Babylonians. And among the wise men of the Babylonians, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. He doesn't know the answer to the dream, and it's a very troubling dream in chapter 2. We're not getting into that right now, a great and important prophecy there. But he doesn't know the dream, and so he says, I want my wise men to tell me the dream. Of course, Nebuchadnezzar is an intelligent man. He knows that anybody can interpret the dream any way they want. How do you know that that's the right interpretation? You get 12 men to interpret the dream, you probably get about 8 different interpretations. How do you know he really knows? He's just making something up, right? I know what I'll do. I can tell he has special powers if he will not only tell me what the dream means, that he'll tell me what I dreamed. So that's where he started. He says, okay, wise men, I want you to interpret my dream. Tell me what I dreamed. And they said, we can't tell you your dream. Yeah, you have to tell me the dream first. And he's saying, if you can't tell me the dream, then I don't know that you can tell me the interpretation either. And they said, well, nobody knows the dream except you and the gods. Well, they weren't stupid. They freely admitted that and were frustrated because they were trapped. And they were also scared because Nebuchadnezzar said that, just kill them all. These are worthless men. Kill them all. So this news filters down even to Daniel and his friends. And that's where Daniel tells his three friends to seek the mercy of God, that we might not only be able to interpret the dream, but reveal to the king his dream. He says, because these things belong to God. And if God will interpret the dream, then we will be able to interpret the dream. So Daniel makes his appeal to the servant of the king, give us this short amount of time, and I will tell the dream. So Daniel does that. So he steps forward. Of course, he's very successful. At the end of chapter 2, the king answered Daniel and said, truly, your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and the revealer of secrets, and you could reveal the secret. And he knew that because Daniel also told him the dream. Daniel knew the dream as well as the interpretation. And Daniel asked the king to promote his friends as well as himself. And so they were all promoted into the kingdom. Chapter 3 is the story of the king making an idol and wanting everybody to bow down to it. And Daniel's not in that event, not in that story. I'm not sure why or where he was. But his three friends were, and they refused to bow down. And so As a side note, they're showing some strong spiritual integrity as well. They're not just claiming to be followers of God and children of God. They're behaving like children of God, and they will bow down to no idol. And so they refuse and are thrown into the fiery furnace, and God delivers them. But we're jumping then to chapter 6, like we've got here in the chart, 5 and 6. That years later, Nebuchadnezzar's dead, and it seems most likely that this is not a son, but a grandson. Belshazzar is the king in... He's the king in Babylon, and he is celebrating, has a great feast, and it's a drunken party, and they're celebrating with pride and arrogance and all that we are and what we've accomplished. And this is where we get the phrase, the handwriting on the wall. It's where it comes from. It's why we say that. What do you mean by that? Something's going to happen. The handwriting is on the wall. Well, that's exactly what happens here. Because as they're enjoying this feast and party, a finger comes and writes on the wall a message that no one can understand. And Belshazzar is deeply, or it says greatly troubled. His countenance was changed and his lords were astonished. And he is so troubled by this that for him the party is over. And someone says, it's the queen, who says, "O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change." In 5:11, "There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy God. And in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers." And said, "You need to talk to him." A lot of time has passed now. And again, it calls Nebuchadnezzar the father, but as you look at the succession of kings, it's probably used in the title sense, not in the dad sense, but that your father, your ancestor, Nebuchadnezzar knew this man, and he was a great help to him. Well, so Daniel's called in. And Daniel looks at the message and understands that this is a message about the destruction and the punishment, even to death, of King Belshazzar. Well, that's not a good message. But you know, he gave Nebuchadnezzar a message like that one time. That's back in chapter 4. When Nebuchadnezzar says, "Daniel, I got another dream." And Daniel says, "You're going to be humiliated. You're going to act and behave like a beast. You're going to lose your throne." And Daniel told him that vision. Now it's time again to bring bad news. And he tells Belshazzar that basically, tonight you're going to die. Here's the interpretation of each word. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. And Belshazzar rewarded Daniel for that message. And that's not normal. Usually the kings destroy the prophet that speaks against them and gives them bad news. But on this occasion, Belshazzar honors him. And Darius, at this point, is the text says about 62. Darius, who becomes the king, that night receives the kingdom at 62 years old. So a new king comes in and conquers the Babylonians. And Babylon is destroyed this very night. So Daniel then is still a prophet of God, telling people what they need to hear, even when they won't want to hear it. Remember how far Daniel was away from home? There's Jerusalem. You go all the way around the Fertile Crescent to the city of Babylon here. And you don't go straight across because that's just desert. And you wouldn't survive that trip. It's too far. But it's thousands of miles that he's away from. Again, the temple and the law. We don't know the last time he wrote the law. Were any copies brought? We're not told about that. Do you think Daniel would have had a copy as a young, you know, teenager maybe, had a copy of the law with him as he began his service in the palace? Daniel is so committed to God. His faith is strong. He's going to do right in every capacity where he can. He can't go to the temple. He will not be a part of any Passover feast. He just can't do any of those things. But he'll do what he can do. And so now he's an old man, enduring all of this time without every representation of God, with God only a part of his heart. And we come to chapter 6, where we are in the story here. And it says, it pleased Darius, this is the new king, Darius, to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom, and over these, three governors, of whom Daniel was one. The text goes on to say that Daniel excelled beyond the others, so that the king was planning on making him the one that was in charge of all the rest of the governors, who would be in charge of the rest of the satraps. This is like number two guy in the kingdom. Didn't say that, but he's up there. He is a high-ranking government official in the nation of Persia. And how did he get there? Well, partly his own integrity, and partly with the blessing of God. It reminds us of the story of Joseph. You remember the slave that sold into Egyptian bondage? And he becomes second only to Pharaoh? Well, here's Daniel. And he's trying to balance this commitment to God in a pagan environment. But verse 3 says, he distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave the thought of setting him over the whole realm. So the governors and the satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. When it says they could not find any charge or fault because he was faithful, let me ask you, faithful to whom? Who are they trying to condemn him to? To make him look bad in front of who? Darius, the Gentile king. That's who they want, the king to turn against Daniel. But Daniel's, they can't find anything to accuse him with because Daniel is faithful. Daniel is faithful to the king. You know, that's a part of the law. That's part of the attitude of God, isn't it? That we are subject to the authorities that are over us. It's a delicate line to walk sometimes more than others, but we're supposed to submit to governments and be respectful of authorities, even those who are pagan or violent or cruel or whatever. We're supposed to behave as godly people, even in that kind of an environment. Daniel was successful at that. And we also know that he's certainly been faithful to God so far. But this faithfulness was to the king. And so they couldn't find any charge against him. So what are they going to do? And in verse 5, then these men said, we shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God. What do they know about his God? What do they know about the law of his God? They know everything about the law of God that they've seen in Daniel. Right? That's their only source of information about God and about the law of God. They know how Daniel lives. They know what he will do and what he won't do. Is it fair for us to assume that he's still not eating the king's delicacies and he's still not drinking of the wine that the king suggests? I'm going to make that assumption. That he's still living faithful to the law of his God. I won't say that. I won't do that. I won't eat that. I will do this and I will do that. And so they know about, yeah, there's this law that he lives by because there is this God that he serves. And this is integrity. Who's watching Daniel? Is he trying to look good in front of his mom and dad? Is he trying to not look bad in front of the members of his synagogue, as it were? The synagogues seem to have come out of this period of time, but we don't know for sure about that, but seem to have grown up since, again, there is no temple. Jews may well gather for prayer and reading or consideration of the scriptures. But Daniel, he's just in an environment that is completely separate from God and godly things. But these men know that that is their hope for bringing Daniel down. And so they think and they make a decision. And they go before the king and they suggest, King, you're so wonderful, you're so great, that we would like to honor you. And we want to honor you by this decree, that no one in all of the realm will bow down to or pray to or give any kind of worship to anyone other than you. You know, pagan people can do that. They can have a god of the month, and they can make their dictator the god of this month if they want to, because paganism is all-inclusive. Worship whatever, whoever, whenever. But they know that that's not the God of Daniel, and that's not the character of Daniel. And so let's make this law, King, and let us use a month wherein we will establish you as the only one worthy of such honor. And they talked the king into writing a law, signing it, putting it in the book that would not be changed. Verse 8, no alteration of that law. Well, let's read in verse 10 of chapter 6. When Daniel knew that the writing... When Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. And in his upper room, with his windows opened toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. There's integrity. Nothing changed for Daniel. Not since the earliest days. There's nothing about him praying in chapter 1. It just talks about him refusing to eat the food that he wasn't supposed to eat. And not going to drink of the wine that he needed to stay away from. And standing alone and standing up to that steward that was in charge of him and say no. And then standing before kings, first Nebuchadnezzar, latest Belshazzar, and certainly maybe multiple times that are not even recorded in the text here. But on those two occasions, or the second before Nebuchadnezzar and the other, were times where he was pronouncing condemnation on the kings. But he told the message that God had given him. And that's integrity, to say what needs to be said. And then finally now, don't worship anybody but the king for 30 days. Does that change Daniel's behavior? No, he's solid. He's solid. It's not a facade of loyalty. It is all the way through. All the way through his heart and all the way through his days and nights. Month after month after year, he's showing us spiritual integrity. He has always been who he has always claimed to be. And it shows itself in these peculiar moments where his faith and his conduct is threatened and challenged. Do we get that? That's when it shows. That's when integrity shows itself. When there's no problem doing what God wants us to do, there's no opposition, there's no conflict here, everybody's kind of in favor of me being a good person and a good guy and telling the truth. Everybody wants me to be honest, and everybody wants me to make careful records that I can sign my name on, and it's the truth. Year after year in the kingdom, he's going to be serving, and everybody's going to love his integrity in all of those areas. And it's a lot easier to do the right thing when people want you to do the right thing. So when does integrity really show itself? When there's pressure in whatever form and from whatever avenue. When there's pressure not to do the right thing. And so in this great story, so simple, the king signs the paper. And, you know, we almost think, well, then right that moment he went and prayed. But the statement is that after the king signed it, Daniel did on this day the same thing he did every day. He prayed three times. And I'm not imagining that he sat down, the king signed it, he sat down, did three prayers in a row, and then went on with his business that day. No. This is just whatever the time schedule might have been, morning, noon, and night seems to fit what might be natural. But that day wasn't any different than any day since the beginning. It says he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before God, as was his custom since the early days. He's always done this. And I like to think about this and say, Daniel, you could have at least left the windows closed, right? Do you have to open the window? Isn't that how you think? There's no value in flaunting it. There's a part of me that thinks that. I feel that. You know, are we supposed to flaunt our and just use our religion and throw it up in the face of people? No, that's not what the Lord calls us to. It's not this offensive kind of a flaunting. He says, you go into your closet and you pray in secret. You know, you're not looking for the praise of men, and you're not looking for to stir up the persecution of men. That's not the point. The point is your sincerity. And so, hide in your closet. And so, why was the
window opened? Well, obviously, because he did it that way every time.
But why does he have to do that every time? Because God can't hear him? Because if he closes the windows, he won't be able to see Jerusalem? You think he could see Jerusalem? Couldn't see Jerusalem. The window being open was just a part of him and this appeal to God. And that, can you imagine? He looked west. And what did he see? He saw the sky. He saw the horizon. But he was looking toward the place. Like Solomon said, you can pray toward this place. And he wanted the window open. So why didn't he close it today? Because those who are opposed to God and godliness want to see if they can bring me down. And they're counting on my integrity. They're counting on the fact that I will do what's right and not alter it. And Daniel's going to give it to him. I'm not saying he thought through that process. But surely he considered not praying. Fleeting moment, maybe, I don't know. Or leaving the window closed. Did God require the Jews to pray three times every day? I'm not sure where that command is found. And it's just the integrity. He's going to do what's right. And it's not a big show. And the people see him praying. Well, they went before the king and they tell the king, well, sorry king, we have to report this. And I'm supposing they put on the show of innocence. Oh, I can't believe Daniel did this. And now you're going to have to get rid of Daniel. And Daniel immediately is angry with himself and with them. And is desperately upset about what he's done because he trusts Daniel. He knows Daniel. And he respects Daniel, loves Daniel. You can read about the good feelings between the king. But the king has got his form of integrity. It's a secular integrity, but it's written in the law, and it cannot be changed, and so I cannot change it. So, okay, you know, it cuts both ways, I guess. But integrity means that you do regardless. That's what integrity means. And so the king shows his secular integrity, and he does that which was greatly displeasing to him in verse 14, and delivers him to the den of lions. Verse 16, but the king spoke, saying to Daniel, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. I think he thought that he really could. And I think he was really hoping that he really would. This may be just wishful thinking, or maybe it's deep-seated faith. But in any respect, we see the attitude of the king in this situation. And Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel after the night in the den. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths so that they had not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you. Well, he did break the law. He did worship God in prayer when the law said, excuse me, but in essence, Daniel did no wrong before the king. His loyalty was to the king, same as it always was. Except that God has my prior and my preeminent honor and worship. The king was glad, brings him up, and later throws all of those other leaders into the den of lions, and they're destroyed. We look at the story, we see the integrity there. A couple of things just to say before, as we wrap it up. You know, everybody knew exactly what Daniel would do. How did they know that? Because he's just been consistent. He's been solid. He's been the same. Day after day after day after day. Do people know what I'm going to do before I do it? Do people anticipate, you know, my conduct? Obviously, not everything. But do people know where
where I will go, where I won't go, what I will say, what I won't say. Integrity is consistent regardless, and so then the tough challenges come. That's when integrity will show itself, that faithfulness that is steadfast and continues regardless. And integrity will not hide or deceive either. And that's the point of him leaving the window open. I've got to be honest with myself and with everybody else about who I really am. This is who I am. It's not just what I do. This is who I am. When you look at me, we need to be able to say this. When you look at me, this is what you see. You're going to see godliness and holiness. Not perfection. I'm working on that too. And people not be surprised by my behavior because they already know what I'm going to do regardless. In bad situations, in bad people, they did not excuse Daniel from his principles. And you look at the story, you say, well, what happened to Daniel wasn't fair. Well, it wasn't fair for him to be taken from Jerusalem or Judea into Babylonian captivity. There was a whole lot of things that weren't fair all the way through. But then that last, those people that deceived the king, of course it wasn't fair. And this life is not fair. There will be no justice here. Not ultimately. And so they cheated Daniel. They trapped Daniel. This was an impossible situation. We find ourselves in what we call impossible situation. This is impossible. What am I going to do? You do what you've always done. Do what you've always done. And maintain and hold on to your integrity. Daniel was all alone in this, and nobody stood with him. He did have his three friends, right? He did have his three friends. They're not a part of this story. We don't know where they are now. But ultimately, our integrity will have to show itself when we're standing all alone, doing the right thing, no matter what. And it had to have been disappointing that the king did not see through the deceit of those other people. And so important for us to see as we think about ourselves that Daniel did not establish integrity by one heroic act. We use the one heroic act as an illustration. That's what integrity does. You see, he prayed anyway. That's not what establishes an integrity. It was integrity that brought about the need for that heroic act. It was the fact that they knew he would not stop praying. How did those men know he would not stop praying? Well, he always prays. Yeah. But when the king's decree comes and the lion's den is out there, then he's going to stop praying. And they knew he wouldn't. See, integrity is not established in the one heroic act. Integrity is established in the little choices, hundreds of them, day by day that we make in moments when we're not even paying attention. And that's why it's important that in our spiritual integrity, it's not that we're making conscious decisions always to tell the truth, but that in our character, in our person, and who we have defined ourselves to be by the Word of God, that integrity would show itself just without thinking. It's just our natural inclination. You know, there's a time in our life maybe when my natural inclination was to take the name of the Lord in vain, to use a curse word when I hit my toe or my thumb. There's natural inclinations. There's a time when those were unconscious reactions, and we spoke the words and said the things we shouldn't have said. If that's true of evil, we can make it true of righteousness, so that who we become spiritually as people of integrity are people of honesty and purity and truth and discipline and control. So that the day comes when there's no impulse to take the name of God in vain when I'm upset. My impulse is to pray to God diligently when I'm upset. And not to curse when I'm suffering injury or pain or even anger. But to well up with sympathy or patience or whatever is needed at that moment. And so integrity is not established in the one heroic act. It's changing ourselves and becoming who we ought to be and then being consistent in that choice of life. It's not just what we do, it's who we are. And, you know, it's good if we could start when we're 12 years old. If at 12 years old we're standing up for the Lord,
So I won't do that. I'm not going to do that. 12 years old. Maybe it's too late for me to start as a 12-year-old. Maybe I better start right now. I need to start as soon as I can, and that's the point there. And we'll face the challenges. And this kind of integrity is what Christianity is about. You look at passages like the Sermon on the Mount, as it describes who blessed people are, and it has to do with their character and their heart and their nature. But are you that really? Are you just being meek and looking meek and acting meek? Or are you meek? Do you appear to be pure in heart? Do you appear to be merciful? Or are you merciful? That's integrity. We are these things. We don't just act like those Beatitudes describe us to be. You are the salt of the earth, and you are the light of the world. You're not just turning on a flashlight once in a while, but you are this constant flame that burns light. That your righteousness has got to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. What was wrong with their righteousness? Oh, they did a lot of the law. They kept more of the law and more details of the law than anybody else. It's just that they were hypocrites. They did it for the wrong reasons, and even in their doing, they didn't do the parts they didn't want to do. There's no integrity there. You got to do better than the Pharisees, who most people consider to be the holiest people on earth. And you've got to control your conduct. Remember that part of the Sermon on the Mount where he says, you know that it said, don't kill. But I'm telling you, don't be angry with your brother. Put that one on. And he says, you know you're not supposed to commit adultery, but if you look on a woman to lust after her, you've committed adultery in your heart already. And you know you're not supposed to break your oath, and I'm telling you, you're not even supposed to need an oath. When you make a statement, that's the truth. And an oath swearing will not make it any more true. That's what the world wants. The world wants, now swear on that, put some money on the table. I want some proof that what you're telling is the truth. And for a child of God, there is no proof stronger than the integrity that speaks. And so there's no need for an oath. Integrity is fundamental and essential to Christians serving the Lord. And we learn it from Daniel. What a great story. From early days to late in life, he's just solid all the way through. I'm not saying Daniel was a sinless man. The sins of Daniel are not explained or reported in the Scriptures. But all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And so Daniel was a sinner like everybody else. Well, he wasn't a sinner like everybody else. He was a sinner who returned to the Lord because of integrity. And repentance is going to be a part of integrity. Repenting, a genuine, a seer, and a sincere, and a full repentance will be a part of being people of God that are morally and spiritually full of integrity. That's the people we need to be. So do we love the Lord? Do we love the Lord enough to worship Him whenever God's people come together? Do we trust the Lord, being willing to make sacrifices for His name, financial or relationship sacrifices or whatever it might be? We need to make choices that are in keeping with the integrity and the spirituality that we claim. I hope the lessons encouraged us and helped us, because we want to put our name there. We want to be able to say, put your name there. Look at him. Look at her. You can see spiritual integrity. Well, how do you see that? Well, I've known them for years. I've seen them in all kinds of circumstances, good and especially bad. They just stay where they need to be. That's what we need to be. And that's the faithful child of God. Certainly want to urge you to grow as you consider Daniel's example of integrity. And if you're not a part of the body of Christ, this is a good opportunity for you to consider coming to Jesus Christ. You've got to repent, turn away from your sins. And in your faith, you'll confess your faith and be baptized for the remission of sins. And as a Christian may be falling away, if we can help you to turn back to God in any way, let us know. We want to help you. And you can even come to the front and let us know as we stand together and sing.